I pledge allegiance to the red, white, and blue.
Hey, welcome to Red, White, and Brews. I'm Gru, your host, Greg Grugan. This is a show where basically we drink beer and talk to people we think are fascinating. I have one here with me. His name is Tony Busby. He's a super lawyer, an entrepreneur, a proud Houstonian, a fighting Texas Aggie. You know, I love his story because, you know, it was hard scrabble, man. Tough. No one gave you a damn thing. You earned it.
Well, they say that people talk about self-made men. But the truth is, no one's self-made. Everybody got a little bit of help along the way. And even if it was something negative that pushed you to go a little harder. So, first in my family to go to college, went in the Marines, and after the Marines, came here to Houston to go to law school.
Hey, look, I'm going to start on a good note.
Yeah.
How high have you been this week after your fight in Texas Aggies managed to get a big win?
I didn't think they could do it. I was a doubter in a big way. For them to go to South Bend and for them to be able to hang in a game like that and to literally win the game on the last play, essentially, really shows that there's something in that program. There's some grit in that program that we haven't seen in a while.
Hey, the country's reeling from, you know, an incredible tragedy. I wanted to get your take because people care about what you think, what Tony Busby's take is. What's your reaction to the assassination of Charlie Kirk?
I watched that, and it's hard to even talk about. I knew him pretty well. When he would come to Texas, he would text me, and I would visit with him. I've always been a supporter of what he was about, and at first it was rage, just rage, and it bothered me. You know, we see shootings all the time, unfortunately, in this country. But that one really, really got to me. And then to see how the media has portrayed the shooter, how they've tried to make this, how they tried to vilify him. I talked to his people the day after, and I said, the one thing we have to do is you have to jealously and aggressively guard his legacy. Do not let these people make him into something that he was not. I'm still kind of feeling that anger. And I watch CNN and I see them try to, I saw one of the commentators say that this was some sort of love story. I just wanted to, I kind of feel like my old man used to be, like, scream at the TV. It's so ridiculous. I mean, this was a misguided, radicalized young person who came from a good family, a solid family, a good father, a Christian home, who somehow, took a hard left turn and is living with another man who's apparently in transition. And he thought that his response to somebody who had the balls, if you will, to go to these schools and to sit there and to take any person that wanted to. I mean, that takes a lot of guts. And for him to be able to do that and to do it in a calm and reasoned and logical way. And this kid, instead of going there and trying to argue and put forth whatever his point of view was, to the extent he even had a point of view, to think that showing up there with his grandfather's bolt-action rifle with a scope and killing this man, it's enraging. And then all the things that have happened after and how this kid has been portrayed and how people are trying to denigrate the legacy of Charlie Kirk. It's troubling. And for people to get on Instagram and Facebook and other places and to just say the most vile things and to celebrate the death of a 30-year-old man who didn't have a violent bone in his body, it really tells you something about the state of our politics in this country, and it's scary.
Tony, I'm gonna borrow the term turning point. We are at a turning point in the country. You know, this can either be a place where we understand what's happened in terms of radicalization, and we take action against it and move forward, or it can tear us apart.
Well, I think people need to wake up a little bit. I think, you know, I served 6 years on the Board of Regents of the A&M system. This system manages now 12 universities. A&M has always been kind of the stalwart, kind of the conservative bastion, if you will, of kids like me that were from small towns, working class families. We had an incident just a few days ago where a particular student did not like the ideology has been preaching to her, and she raised her hand and argued back, and she's kicked out of the class. And then the president is not being honest about some of the things that were said and done. And when I served on that board, you know, they would present to us 4 times a year every potential professor who was up for tenure. And I mean, we're talking about a notebook, maybe 2 notebooks, and the only information you had was they'd have a resume. And we didn't have the ability to go and research their backgrounds, look at their Facebook posts, any of that thing. So we basically had to vote en masse. Either they get tenure or they don't get tenure. And you really not really clear what you're getting. And that's the kind of thing we're getting. And if you don't have a board of regents, a president, somebody who's really watching what these professors are doing, you have situations like we had with Charlie Kirk. I hate to connect the two, but there is a connection there. You know, this young person who seems to be on the right path, all of a sudden veers off very badly, and the next thing you know, you have an assassination on live TV, and everybody is just up in arms.
Yeah, I'm deeply troubled, but I think this can be a place where we as a country become stronger, and we see who's wrong and who's right and the path we need to follow. Hey, stay with us. Red, White, and Bruise will be right back.
I pledge allegiance to the red, white, and blue. I pledge allegiance to the red, white, and blue.
Yeah, welcome back to Red, White, and Bruise with my friend. I like to call him my friend, Tony Busby.
Hey, we're friends.
Hey, and I was telling you earlier, your business is not so much different than my business in that there are 3 components, greed, power, and desire, sexual desire.
Oh, I wondered if you were going to add that in there.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, I'm gonna veer away from that last one.
Well, you know, I go back, you know, even your big cases holding petrochemical companies accountable, mm-hmm. and then the legion of other cases, mm-hmm. there's always a component of those three in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I covered you most recently in the role of defense in the impeachment trial of Attorney General Ken Paxton.
Yeah.
You won that case.
Yeah.
You successfully defended him in the Senate. I'd like to get, you know, a couple of your thoughts about why did you take it? And when you get down to the lick log, you know, why did you win it?
I got a text of somebody that had gotten a text from Ken, and they said, would you be willing to help the Attorney General? I said, well, I had defended the governor, as you may recall, in his
Rick
indictment.
Perry.
Yeah. And, you know, we were all feeling our way because this hadn't happened in 100 years. But, you know, my thing is, if it's an interesting case and if it's something that I think is kind of sexy, I want to be involved in it. I don't want to be the guy that, you know, when I'm 75, 80, and somebody says, well, you're a lawyer, the biggest case that there ever was in the state of Texas happened back, you know, 30 years ago. What was your role in it? Well, I was shoveling shit, you know, in River Oaks. Yeah. You know, I want to be in the mix. So I was called, I went to right outside of Dallas, and there was just a big room full of lawyers that you might expect. And there were lawyers on the conference line from D.C. and New York, and everybody was, you know, jockeying for position. And Ken is a real strategic thinker, and he knew that the case was not a criminal case. He knew it was a political case, and he knew that the public relations arm of it was very important. And so everybody went around and said their piece, and I was the last one. And the Attorney General said to me, Tony, what do you think? And I said, General, I don't, you know, none of us have ever done this before, so let's not pretend like we know what we're really doing. But one thing I know for sure is somebody, one person needs to be in charge. We're not going to do this by committee. And he looked at me and he said, okay, then it's going to be you. And that began about a 6 month just drinking through a fire hose of probably the most interesting case I've been involved in and one of the toughest cases because there were really no rules. And shortly after that, our first press conference, which I thought it was very important that we get out and we put a counter narrative out there, the lieutenant governor shut us down. He entered a gag order. And then so we were kind of fighting with both arms behind our back. but what I realized early on was, is that the 31 senators that were behind us were not the decision makers. Most everyone else, I feel quite certain the prosecutors felt like that the senators were in fact the jury. They were technically the jury, but they were getting their information from Twitter, Instagram, and all of these other sources, and they were following it very closely. They didn't have their phones, but as soon as the day was over, they went, they got their phones immediately, and they were looking at who had called their office, what was being said on Twitter. And so I realized that was going to be the case. So my audience, people were wondering, like, what the devil is Busby doing? I was talking to the right activists. That was my audience. So the whole thing about George Bush, all those things that people thought were kind of non sequiturs, that was right in the strike zone of how we had to convince probably about six senators who were on the fence to vote our way. And I felt pretty confident once they put up their first two or three witnesses and we really chewed them up pretty good. And I had somebody monitoring Twitter, and Twitter was saying, oh, this case is over. And, you know, and I'm the kind of person, when I put my foot on your neck, I don't stop. You know, I keep the gas on. And so that day, I think it was a Saturday, perhaps, when the vote came in, I was feeling pretty good about it. I think the attorney general was feeling good about it. But it was incredibly historic, you know, to have your lieutenant governor as your judge, to have large portion of the Texas House as the prosecutors, and to have the Texas Senate as the jury, and to have the Attorney General as your client. I don't think very few lawyers could ever say that.
And you're at your core a competitor.
Absolutely.
You beat Rusty Hardin.
Yeah, you know, Rusty, to his credit, Rusty kind of had his arms tied behind his back. He didn't probably get to do the things that I got to do. Because on our side, there were really two decision makers. It was me and Ken Paxton. On his side, they were operating by committee. And I don't think they ever knew who their jury really was.
Look, there's an old concept. You may beat the rap, but you may not beat the ride. And for Ken Paxton, he's in a political fight right now with an incumbent senator who's spending millions and millions of dollars attacking the character of Ken Paxton. As you watch this unfold, any thoughts?
I do have some. I will tell you this. At some point during the impeachment, I said to Ken Paxton, I said, we're going to win this, and you're going to be the next U.S. senator. This was all part of the plan. And when he came out, and because I kept urging him, like, go ahead and announce. When he announced, because he's very, like I say, strategic, very smart, he was 17, 20 points ahead. Some people say that's tightened because of these attacks on his character, but those attacks on his character have essentially gone on his entire career. So I think at the end of the day, Ken Paxton will be the next U.S. senator, even though any incumbent, whether it Democrat, Republican, Senate, or a House member, they have a built-in advantage in the way they can raise money and the way they can spend money. And it makes it almost impossible for an incumbent or to beat an incumbent. But I think he'll win.
All right. Lots more to talk about. Stay with us, Red, White, and Bruce. We'll be right back.
I pledge allegiance to the red, white, and blue. I pledge allegiance to the red, white, and blue.
All right, here with Tony Busby, Red, White, and Bruce. Tony, lightning round. I mean, because people will kill me if I don't ask
about. We didn't even talk about the brews.
Well, you know, you're drinking a little Diet Coke there.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, you're looking good.
Clean myself up here.
All right, let's go first to a huge case, Deshaun Watson.
Deshaun Watson case would have never happened. The first alleged victim called my office four times, and I was kind of, my arm was twisted to take the case. When I visited with the alleged victim, I really believed her. I agreed to do only one thing, send a letter on her behalf. But his people, when I sent the letter, were so arrogant and were so dismissive that they really, really pissed me off. And when I filed the first case, and then his new team here in Houston, his local team, they pissed me off even further. And, you know, so he went from probably being able to settle a couple of cases confidentially to one of the biggest sports stories that went on for over a year that cost him major endorsements and really severely impacted his career, all because of the bad lawyering.
And he's never been the same.
Never since. Been the same.
All right. Diddy.
P. Diddy. Yeah. Well, you know, there was a lawyer out of California that, you know, had seen the Deshaun Watson cases and had signed up a few cases about Diddy and some people that alleged Diddy had done certain things. And so, you know, once we put the word out that we were going to pursue these cases, you know, the people came out of the woodworks. And the truth is, of all the calls we've had, they probably whittled down to about 100 legitimate cases, and they're just kind of slowly winding their way through the court system.
Tony, I mean, the allegations, I mean, look, I know you have a good heart, but it's got to be hard to dig into that stuff and to see depravity.
Unfortunately, in my career, I've pretty much seen it all, and nothing really surprises me. Behind that veneer of show business is a lot of ugliness, the ugly underbelly of the entertainment industry and the things that people do and the things that are done to people. It doesn't shock me anymore. It's just how things are.
All right. The latest and potentially biggest case in our town, you know, talk about the case involving the Houston Texans.
Yeah, there's a real dispute about and concerning the Texans. I won't go into it too much. I represent Kerry McNair. There's a dispute as to how he was relieved from his position in McNair Interests. McNair Interests is a billion-dollar business that he built with his dad, Robert, or Bob. And, you know, he was always kind of the right-hand man for Bob. He was always the business guy. He was always the one that Bob leaned on and relied upon. Kerry never really wanted to be involved with the Texans itself. In fact, he was offered that when he lived in Austin, and he was like, "Dad, I'm doing my own thing." But some of the things that have happened and some of the things that are going to come out about the inner workings of the Texans are going to be very ugly. And hopefully we can get the thing resolved without all that ugliness. But if it comes to that, you know me, I'll be your huckleberry.
Well, that's why you get these cases, because you're not shy and you usually win.
I do pride myself on usually winning. Winning is an attitude that you have from the moment that you open your eyes. You know, the first thing I do when I open my eyes in the morning is thank God for another day. And then I began to organize myself about what I'm going to do to advance my cause and the cause of my clients.
Hey, winning has a lot to do with the people around you. And you have a lovely wife that's played a big role in that. You want to make a shout out?
Yeah, Frances is – Frances, we've been married now. We've been together almost 7 years. And she – you know, I was kind of – let's be honest. You know, I was kind of – I was catting around and I was doing a lot of things. And you know, she – you know, it's kind of like that line from the movie. She makes me want to be a better person.
Hey, you've been watching John Whitmire run your city. Thoughts there? I've been a big fan. You know, there was a lot of damage to undo.
John came into a situation that was almost untenable and has worked. You know, like he says, he's not a show pony. He's a workhorse. I like that. I like that attitude. It's like, roll your sleeves up. You know, I don't care who I piss off. We're going to get this done. We're going to fix the corruption. We're going to fix how we pick up trash. We're going to fix the drainage, all these things. I've been very impressed. I mean, he's a Democrat, but he's a working man's Democrat. And you know, we had a huge water main that was leaking next to my house. And I called the city 3 or 4 times. And then I I texted John. I said, you know what? This has been here for 2 or 3 days, John. And I'm surprised he wasn't out there fixing it himself, but it got fixed.
Man, I've been loud and proud. I think probably because I saw how low our city had fallen.
Yeah.
And he wants to fix it. He wants to fix it. And he's done it so far without raising anybody's taxes.
God bless him.
You know.
The money's there. And I think it bothers me that the people of his own party criticize him for trying to be bipartisan. That bothers me. It bothers me that now apparently some members of his party think that raising taxes is the only thing they're good at. He doesn't believe that. At least it appears that he doesn't believe that. He's a real workhorse, and I've been favorably impressed with him. Really have. He is the right guy for the job.
You know who I'm favorably impressed with?
Who's that?
You, man.
Oh, well, thank you.
You're happy.
Thank you. I'm very happy.
All right. Hey, will you come back and talk to me again?
Absolutely. Whatever. You know me. I can talk.
I'll have the Diet Coke iced, and if you want a Lone Star Light or whatever we got going.
I'll pass on that, but I'll definitely have a Diet Coke.
Okay, Tony, thanks for being here. Hey, join us next time for another stellar edition of Red, White, and Bruise. I've been to-